Brandon, let's just get to know you a little bit.
Sure.
At Wesley Institute, lecturing there in arts and theology and Old Testament.
That's right.
You have a PhD in related fields to that.
Yep, Old Testament.
Old Testament. Uh-huh. And you obviously love film. Do you have a favourite film that you...
Whoa, I've got a favourite 100 films.
Yeah. What comes to mind?
Man, that'd be tough. It depends for what. Look, I guess something intelligent action, really. Intelligent.
Oh, sorry. Okay, intelligent action.
Well, some of the films I'll talk about today would be my top 100, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Good. And you married? Family situation?
Married, kids from 11 down to 17 weeks. Four boys, right? I'm jet lagged, I'm baby lagged, so that's why I can't count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 boys, yes.
Yeah. Now, I'll just open the prayer now and
please
hand it over to you. And we have about 40 minutes for Grenville to explain the topic and then we'll have some time for questions.
Sounds good.
Let me pray.
Yep.
Well, we thank you for this world that we can enjoy. We thank you for your gospel. We thank you for the gifts and abilities that you give each of us. And we pray that you help us to be more effective in understanding how to use film for your glory.
Amen. Thanks very much, Owen. Morning. Afternoon, guys. I really am baby lag. This is bad. This is terrible. How's your day been so far? Good. Mine too. I've been spent the morning with theology students, actually, which is always an adventure in... got my best profile. There you go. And there you go. My agent will contact you later and you can... Yeah. No problem. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yes. Look. Yes. So true. You save a lot, but you spend a lot on, you know, buff whenever I... Yeah, that's right. Mr. Sheen. Right, enough bitter and cruel jokes about my hirsuteness or otherwise. I guess you've done this a million times. I, a couple of weeks ago, went to a movie with a mate of mine and also a mate of his who I'm getting to know. The friend of mine is an atheist. The mate of his is, I guess you'd say, a very liberal or almost lapsed Muslim. And we toddled off to see an Australian film, a crime film, and afterwards went out for pizza, and the conversation began. And you can imagine where it went. We talked about the aesthetics of the film. You've had this conversation a million times. We then talked about some of the themes of the film, the performances, and all the usual stuff. And then we got onto the question of morality. And they kind of hooked into me, because they know of my Christian faith, and said, oh, I guess from a Christian perspective, you know, you'd be judging that, and you'd be... I'm going, why do everyone always think we're judgmental? But anyway, and from a Christian perspective, you wouldn't agree with a lot of the things in that film. And I said, well, neither would you. It's a crime film. They were like, yeah, that's true. I said, well, so anyone in a civilized society probably wouldn't agree with most of the things in that film. Yeah, that's true. And then we got... They tried to make it about where they disagree with Christian morality. And they took a poke at their understanding of Christian morality, which is not necessarily representative of mine. And they'd poo-hoo some of our stance on various issues. And without wanting to argue those details and get into a petty nitpick session, even with friends in a friendly way, I actually cut to what I hope was a deeper question and said, look, we could argue over some of the ins and outs of euthanasia or whatever, but more deeply than that, what's going on with morality at all? How does one establish that there even is such a thing as morality if we are simply competing and evolving organisms in a jungle? How do you get morality out of that? And I kind of put the question back onto them in a playful way, hope it was, where do you get your morality from? And they said, well, society. That was the obvious one, society. We want to live in a civilized society. And I don't want him stealing my stuff and harming my people. And so I'll return the favor and I'll treat him in a civilized way so that it's a social contract. That's the basis of morality. And I said, okay, good start. That probably helps you if you're in the right society. But what about if you're in society, Australia, 1840s, where Charles Darwin comes in on the Beagle and says, Oh, look at Tasmania. They all got together in a line and pushed all their native population into the sea, killed them, stuck the last remaining ones out on an island. And he comes and says, Australia, the colony has the advantage of being free from a native population. He says, this most cruel step seems to have been quite unavoidable. And he refers to our indigenous fellow citizens as the second lowest form of human life, a clear link between man and the apes. And rather than being morally outraged at that, we name a territory after him, or a capital city. What if you're living in that kind of a society? Where does morality come from then? And how can a person within that kind of society appeal to a higher morality in trying to drag people beyond that? And now it was getting a bit sweaty. It was getting a bit kind of interesting. And they were going, oh, they realized that they kind of was, their argument was missing a leg. And they turned it back onto me and they said, all right, smarty pants, well, where do you get your morality? And in a good-natured way, you know, we're mates. And I said, well, I'll tell you where I don't get it. I don't get it from science. Because you've got Stephen Jay Gould, for example, saying nature contains no moral messages framed in human terms. You can't get a sense of morality out of biology. Plenty of people try. Peter Singer tries. But not surprisingly, he comes up with a morality that privileges you according to your intellectual ability, according to your brain. So your value, in fact, in one published work, he talks about the fact that a dolphin is more valuable than a very handicapped human being because it has a higher IQ. So now we have IQ as the judge, the criterion by which a person is judged and the basis of morality. You'd expect an Oxford PhD to say that, right? Because it would put him in the upper echelons. And I think that illustrates the fact that any human being, if I invented a morality, it would probably privilege my set. Bald people everywhere, for example. And so, you know, the subjectivity of that is just stunning. So where do you get ultimate morality from? And we're having this discussion, you know, and it was getting quite passionate and we were getting quite into it. So you can't get it from society, but you can, and I respect the attempts of lawmakers and leaders to do that. But really, the social contract thing breaks down because what I really would do if I'm smart and if I'm really all about getting advantage over my competitors so that my genes go into the next generation, I would pretend to be a good neighbor to you so that you wouldn't take my stuff. But if I could secretly take your stuff, I would do it. And that would be the smartest thing to do. And do some of our leaders behave like that? Sure they do. And so, to get morality from society, to get it from science, I don't think it's adequate. And they said, well, you're going to say God, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, it's as if you can't think for yourself. I said, well, I think you can think for yourself. I think God has given us that ability and encouraged us to do it. But why should I ultimately care about somebody else if they're my competitor? I'd really only care if they're my brother or sister in some sense. And if I'm accountable to a common parent, to our father. Oh. And I said, and ultimately you can't get a morality other than based on some view of deity. So they were back at me. Well, which religion then? Because they're all pushing a different kind of morality. And I said, yeah, granted, I'm not trying to argue over that at the moment. I'm ducking that dumper and I'm going down to a deeper argument and saying the fact that there's morality at all can't work, ultimately, unless there's a deity. They were like, right. And you can see the Muslim guy kind of accessing some of the arguments of his childhood and going, yeah, that's kind of true. And the atheist going, and again, he did the predictable next move. He said, ah, what, so you're telling me that because I don't believe in a God, I'm not a moral person? I said, no, I'm so not saying that. I said, some of my non-believing friends put me to shame in the morality they live up to. And sometimes I think, my God to shame in some of the things I think or want to do or sometimes even do. So I'm not pulling that one at all. And they were like, oh, okay. You could see the atheist kind of going, drats, I thought I had you there. But in a sense, what's going on there? That's a pretty, I mean, okay, it's a somewhat nerdy conversation. It's perhaps not the typical post-movie conversation. But I'd argue it's a fairly natural thing to do, to go out with mates, to see a film, and to talk about it afterwards. And what I was trying to do is to remove some of the stumbling blocks those guys had to coming towards the gospel. Because why do I need a gospel if I don't believe I'm morally flawed in some way? If I don't believe there's an absolute standard of love and goodness, below which I often fall, what would I need a savior for? If my 10 commandments are, I'm as good as the next 10 people in the bus next to me, I don't need a gospel. I can justify myself by comparison. But if I have a sense of morality that is greater than I am and a sense of need from that, then I might go looking for a savior. I think those guys were at step one. What am I trying to do? I guess in the next 30 minutes or so, I'd like to advocate that as a model by which Christians can do a couple of things. First of all, we can do an apologetical cleanup job of some of the messes that get between people and belief in the gospel and experience with Christ. I think we can do that. The other thing I think we can do is actually learn something and push ourselves and be confronted and challenged and driven back to scripture and back to prayer ourselves from the conversations we have with our non-believing mates. And I think it's worth analysing films from that perspective. What I'd like to do is just quickly float a couple of films with you. But first of all, I wanted to make the point that I think film is massive within our culture. I almost don't need to say this. You've got George Miller, who's made some classic Australian films, saying this: I believe cinema is now the most powerful secular religion, and people gather in cinemas to experience things collectively as they once did in church. Ouch. Cinema storytellers have become the new priests. They're doing a lot of the work of religious institutions, which have so concretized the metaphors in their stories and taken so much of the poetry, mystery, and mysticism out of religious belief that people look for other places to question their spirituality. It annoys me how true that is. It annoys me. You've got John C. Lydon in his book Film as Religion. Says that Western culture draws its myths, its morals, and its symbols from film. And he says those are traditionally the domain of religion. Normally it's religion that gives us our myths in a grand sense. He doesn't mean that they're not true. He's just saying big stories. And our morals and our kind of cultural symbols traditionally came from religion. So he says, really, film is the new religion. And therefore, we can use religions in trying to reach Western culture can use a comparative religion model. It's almost like we're dialoguing with a Muslim or we're talking to a Buddhist when we're talking to a secular Western cinema goer. That's what Lydon argues. And so dialogue is the model that he advocates. And I think he's spot on right. The, in my view, very good Christian apologist Ravi Zacharias talks about arguing for Christianity at three levels. You may be familiar with this stuff. I'll go fairly quickly through it. He talks about, first of all, you're arguing at the level of ideas and philosophy. I guess that's what I was doing with my mates after that film. Can you really say there's no such thing as right and wrong? Is there a basis for morality that is solid? The second level, then, is the arts. You can take those ideas and philosophies, put them into a story, and see how it works. You know, play it out. And then, of course, you've got the kitchen table level. If there's no right and wrong, well, what does that mean for me? Does it mean, yahoo, you know, you better lock your house because I'm coming over? Or what? So to take that example, the statement, there are no moral absolutes. We could argue about that at a philosophical level, and we could play silly games like saying, well, if there are no moral absolutes, then that statement falls over because it is a moral statement, and it's an absolute moral statement. It just shot itself in the toe. And if there are moral absolutes, well, then that statement's wrong. And we could critique it at that kind of a level. That'd be fun for 5 minutes or so. But then, the arts. And we can take a film like Lord of War, which I'll briefly discuss in a moment. Has anyone seen that, by the way? Lord of War? About five of us? Okay. What did you think? Yeah. Me too. Yeah, agreed. Just for the tape, the comment was that the gentleman's quite upset by it because of the arms business that doesn't take into account the results of, you know, in people's lives and the outcomes. We'll talk about that in just a second. Then you've got the kitchen table level, which just says, well, if there's no moral absolute, how could I live like that? What would my life look like? Wouldn't make sense. Why is it that I feel a sense of right and wrong? Why is it that just about every person would agree You know, even those who say there's no right and wrong would start to agree when you say, I like to torture baby fur seals. They go, oh, that's wrong. Or if you said, rape is fun, they go, most sensible, ordinary, normal people would go, oh, you're sick. Why is it that those extreme and perhaps silly examples show to us that we do have a moral sense? And where did that come from? Do you know? And so we could argue in that way. As for the film, I would highly recommend it, even though, like you, I came out of the cinema quite depressed going to see it. I took a bunch of mates, not because I like going around depressing people, but because I just wanted them to sense the moral impact of it. What it is, Nick Cage plays an arms dealer called Yuri Orlov who comes to America from Russia and realizes that the best way to make money is to sell guns to desperately poor little third world nations. It's actually a semi-factual film. It's based on the life of a couple of arms dealers who, when the Soviet Union collapsed, went and bought up the incredible military stockpiles of the Soviet Union and sold them into Africa and Asia, in the main, and also the Balkans and so forth. And he made insane amounts of money. As the film's slogan says, he's making a killing. And it just shows you this guy, and it shows you how, you know, I think it's a very brainy film. It's actually very cleverly done. I've watched it with groups now probably 30 times, and every time I go away going, that's a really clever text. It's got him and also his brother. He has a younger brother who is much more a sensitive soul. And he has a sign up. He's a chef in a restaurant. He's a bad chef. And he's a bit keen on the vodka. You see that kind of a gentleness and a weakness in his personality. And he's got a sign up that says, beware of the dog. And the big brother, the arms dealer, comes and goes, what do you got that up for? Beware of the dog. He goes, to remind myself to beware of the dog in me. The one that just wants to fight, and another word that alliterates, everything that moves. And the big brother goes, well, what if that's the best part of being a human being, the dog part? And the younger brother goes, no, I want to beware of that. And you can see, they're talking, am I an animal, just an animal, or do I have a soul in some sense? And what's going on? They're from a Jewish family, and the father's always talking about, remember what is above you. And there's one stage where the arms dealer goes, Dad, I know it's above me. It's a $20,000 chandelier, you know? That's all. And he just lives for money. And the film pulls no punches. It just watches this guy's moral trajectory, and it's down, down, down all the way. It doesn't back off. It doesn't have a nice Hollywood ending where he has a hug and a learning experience. It just unsparingly drives you into the ground and shows you what would happen if you removed all sense of morality. And you see him selling arms to African warlords who in the morning will buy his guns, and in the afternoon, you see it on the film, will gun down a whole camp, refugee camp of innocent people with those weapons. And you see the younger brother with a conscience falling to bits and becoming addicted to cocaine. You see Yuri, the dealer, becoming quite depraved in his own life as well. He has a marriage based on fraud and sham and lies. And of course, then he has other people on the side. And you see his sexuality becoming pretty corrupted and pretty sick. And you see him becoming addictive. You see him trying to numb the obvious guilt he feels. But the greed just won't let him stop. And at the end of the film, I'm going to spoil the ending in all the three films today. So please run screaming from the room if you plan on watching them. But he at the end of it, you see him, he's lost the love of his parents. They've held a funeral for him. He's been arrested. He's lost his wife and son. The little son who, when he played with the plastic gun, his father confiscated and threw it in the bin. Get the double standard of that. It's okay to kill other people's kids, but my boy's not going to be troubled in his lovely Manhattan apartment. And you just watch his life go, whoop. And at the end, there's this very moral agent who kind of represents the law and righteousness. And he kind of goes, he will never break the rules. He's a terrier for justice. And at the end, he gets him. I've got you. And he's got him in a prison. He's caught him. And Yuri, the arms dealer, just says, in about 5 minutes, an official's going to come and set me free because the President of the United States is the biggest gun dealer in the world, and he needs people like me to do the dirty work he doesn't want to do. And sure enough, it happens. And the agent says, I'd say go to hell, but I think you're already there. But he goes on fine. He's rich as, he's living his life, and the film ends with him just selling more guns. And you come out going, is that really the world that we live in? Well, yeah, that film's based on fact. It was supported by Amnesty International, and various other groups who are trying to make a moral point about arms dealing. Because the biggest arms dealers in the world are the four permanent members of the UN Security Council. Go figure that one. It's called money. And you come to the end and you go, is that really what life is like? And I guess that takes that moral arm. Look what would happen if you took all morals out of the picture. And you go, that'd be pretty ghastly. The Bible also, I think, uses a very similar kind of plot in one of its narratives. And this is a narrative I don't commonly hear preached, although certainly I've one of the churches I attend a bit, it's there in the sermon library, but there's a similar story of that in the book of Judges. And I think it's making the same moral point, if you ask me. Have you read the one where that terrible mass rape scene and the dismemberment of the poor woman? Some of you are nodding with a kind of a grimace. Looking forward to this, aren't you guys? But this is a story where I think the Bible does that same thing. What if you took away all morality? And it begins as a love story. You've got this young couple who are, you know, in love. They're a de facto couple. He hasn't married her. They break up. She gets angry. Judges chapter 19. And she goes back to her parents or her dad. And after a few months, he thinks, oh, I miss her. And he goes off to speak to her heart and to win her back. And the father welcomes him into the house, and there's all these scenes of come and eat and drink and be merry, and yeah, it's great to have you back. Oh, son, oh. And there's all this hospitality. It's all very lovely. And they try to go. He says, come on, honey, let's go home. And the father's like, no, stay another day. The fridge is only still half empty. Stick around. You know, all this lavish Eastern hospitality. And you think, this is lovely. This is really redeeming and warm and nice. Let's go. No, stay another day. And then finally, let's go. No, no, we've really got to go. Okay, so they leave in the afternoon. And they're heading through some pretty rough areas, and night falls. And you're like, uh-oh, that's bad atmospherics. And then the servant says, look, why don't we stop at one of these Canaanite towns around here and see if we can't get a bed for the night? And the proudly Israelite man says, no way, we're not going to stop at a Canaanite town. You kidding me? We're going to press on to one of our towns. We're going to go and spend the night in the Bible Belt, you know, where all the Israelites live, and we'll be fine. And so off they go. And that's the irony. And you go, oh, what's going to happen now? They go to Gibeah. And they wait in the town square to be taken in as hospitality in that culture demands. Doesn't happen. And finally, an old man who's not from around there, but he's living there now, comes and says, spend the night in my house. No, we'll be fine. We'll camp in the open square. No, you really won't. Trust me. Come and spend the night in my house. And so they do. And it's all hospitable and nice and lovely. And then the men of the city, all of them, bang on the door. And they throw themselves at the door. They shout it to the old man who owned the house, bring out the man who came to your house so that we may know him. And they don't mean in a social sense, despite what one scholar argues, actually. And so he's like, this is a familiar scene. Is this reminding you of another story? You think you're back in Sodom, right? And he actually goes out and says exactly the same things to that mob as Lot said to the mob with the same things on their mind. No, my brothers, that's very redeeming and gracious of him. No, my brothers, do not do this vile thing. Okay, you're not vile, but don't do that vile action. This man is my guest. Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. I'll bring them out to you now and you can use them and do to them whatever you want. Key line. But to this man, don't do such a disgraceful thing. And so they didn't listen. So he's read his Bible story. He knows what Lot does. Offer to give your daughters to the mob. Now, this is extremely controversial. And it seems like, actually, Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, uses this as an example of what a hideously immoral and sexist book the Bible is. Because it reports this terrible scene. What a blunder. I mean, Dawkins tells you the way he reads the Bible. He says that you can learn morals from the Bible in two ways. One, by commandments, and two, by example. What a simplistic grid. What, if we applied the same thing to Shakespeare, we'd say Shakespeare's in favour of killing Scottish kings. Think about it. It just doesn't make sense. But anyway, he reads this story and goes, oh, you know, obviously, whatever this crazy story is about, it obviously shows what a low view the Bible has of women. I go, completely missed the point. It reports this horrible scene. So does the Sydney Morning Herald from time to time. Does it approve of it? Of course not. And we'll see why in a second. But so In this case, though, they put the women out. Now, you know what happens in the Lot story. That's what you do. You say to this mob who wants male flesh, you can have my daughters. And it looks really friendly. It's kind of like offering a bacon sandwich to a Jew, you know. It looks really friendly, but you know they're not going to take it. It's not what they're interested in. But instead, in this case, this Israelite mob goes, fine, and they grab the poor woman, and one of the saddest texts in the Bible, they raped her and abused her throughout the night. And at dawn, the cowardly dogs who couldn't face the light let her go. Oh, and once you've recovered from the shock of that one, the writer just twists the knife even a bit more. At daybreak, the woman went back to the house where her master was staying, fell down at the door, and lay there until daylight. When her master got up in the morning and opened the door of the house and stepped out to continue on his way, there lay his concubine, fallen in the doorway of the house. As if that's not bad enough, get the nice little dusting touch at the end, with her hands on the threshold. So you get this close-up of a feminine hand reaching out for help from the man who supposedly loves her, but the help doesn't come. Ugh. But it gets worse. He runs out and goes, quick, get up, let's go. I don't know how to... If I were this guy's defense lawyer, I guess I'd say, well, he let it happen. He didn't know it was happening, or he decided he'd, you know, help her in the morning. If he went out, 100 men would have killed him and he wouldn't have survived. Blah, blah, blah. I wouldn't believe myself. I think the guy's a cad. I think he should have gone out there. Even if he took out 10 of them before they took him down, at least that's a statement, isn't it? Maybe that's stupid. But it's his horrible moral position that he's in. Then he grabs it and he finds that there's no answer. She's dead. Although the writer has too much finesse to actually say it, she's dead. He just says, there's no answer. So he picks up her body, puts her on the donkey, carries her back home. And then comes the scene that just rocks contemporary audiences and just, blah, talk about cut through. He takes her home and cuts her body into 12 pieces. And you can read that and go, what kind of a sick freak, what kind of a Hannibal Lecter is this fool? But remember the culture. This is a part of the world where even today, what do you do if your loved one's blown up by the other side? You take the fragments of their battered bodies, you put them on an open coffin, and you bear them down the main street, and you get as much publicity as you can for your pain, to honor them in that culture, and to make the point, look at those, did to this person I love. And you show, I come from a, you know, culture where all the coffins are closed, and it's all very stiff upper lip and all that. But these guys, it's show your grief, it's show your pain, show your brokenness at a funeral. And I think that's what he's doing. He's trying to send out this moral message. He's trying to get 6 o'clock news publicity for this scandalous event that's taken place to the woman that he kind of loved. And a part of her body goes to all the state capitals on market day. And you can imagine everyone milling around and going, oh, look, it's a parcel from, what's the story with that? And the story goes through the entire nation of this scandal. And everyone who saw it said, such a thing has never been seen or done, not since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt. Think about it, consider it, and tell us what to do. What do we do morally? Ah, we're in this moral mess. What's right and wrong anymore? Ah, we know this is wrong. Israel, of course, has been living away from God, generally. They've been ditching the commandments. And it's interesting, when you read through the book of Judges, you notice, when you look at the piece of literature, you've got this cycle that begins in the early chapters. You've got them, first of all, and it kind of goes like this. They do evil in the eyes of Yahweh, their personal name for God. They do evil in the eyes of Yahweh. So what's their moral reference point? The eyes of Yahweh. Cool. Then what happens? He sells them into captivity to nation X. And they are slaves to X for Y years. And then, at rock bottom, they cry out to Yahweh. And it's not in repentance, necessarily. It's just a bit of a moan. God, how could you get us into this mess? What have you done to us? Kind of thing. And then it says, and Yahweh raises up a deliverer or a judge. Deliverer Zed, and has a victory, and then the land has rest for a years. And that cycle goes round and round and round. through the early chapters of the book of Judges. Round and round and round it goes. It's like an addictive cycle, in a sense. And it's beautiful if you read it in the context of the ancient world, because the ancients had a view that that's how history went. History goes round and round. Look at the seasons. Summer, autumn, winter, spring. Summer, autumn, winter, spring. Round and round we go. That's the pagan view of how life functions. Round and round. And it seems like Israel has become pagan. Israel has fallen into the type of history that the pagans expect. And it just goes round and round like that a number of times in those early chapters of Judges. And then that cycle starts to fall to bits. It starts to, like a descented washing machine, it just starts to judder and shake and fall to pieces. And bits fall off it. And there comes a point where God doesn't respond, even though they cry out to him. Or other times where a judge comes, but God hasn't raised them up. Or the people have chosen him, and the judge turns into an absolute dictator and a swine. Like Gideon, if you read the second half of the Gideon story. Round and round it goes, and then eventually it all stops, and you don't get that anymore. You just have a whole lot of bad judges. And then we get this story right at the bitter end of the book of Judges, just as it's about to power dive into the deck and explode. This story comes up, Judges 19. And you're going, you're kidding me. And so there's this huge national get-together of all the men. I think it says six times. All the men of Israel got together and said, what do we do? What's the moral thing to do here? And so they go, I know, we have to kill the guys who did this. And the tribe says, no, you can't have them. And so there's this civil war, and they fight the Benjamites. Long and bloody civil war. I'll cut the story short. There's terrible loss of life. God's will is not clear in what happens, at least not to them. And they end up, they've just about wiped out the tribe of Benjamin. Great, we showed them. Oh, we've just weakened ourselves by 1/12. We've just lost one of our tribes. Whoops. Okay, well, all right. They need to breed. They need to get their numbers up again. We need to give them women to breed with. How do we do that? We've promised God that we'll never give our daughters to a Benjamite. Loophole. Instead of giving our daughters to a Benjamite, we'll let our daughters go to this cultural dancing festival. We'll tell the Benjamite men, hey, there's a whole lot of girls over there. Grab them if you want. We're not actually giving them technically, are we? Oh, that's clever. We'll just let them take these wives and yahoo, we fixed the problem. And so they do. And the men of Benjamin come, and in a predatory way, they just grab women that they like the look of and take them home as wives. And so the abuse of one woman turns into the hideous abuse of hundreds who begin their married life against their will and are virtually prisoner brides. And you're like, good one, fellas. Really well managed. You did great. And the book of Judges ends with that. And Benjamin's getting its numbers back up again. But what a mess. Only a human being could come up with a mess like that. One unguided by God's guidance. And I would be doing my block at the end of this book. I would be preaching that point. I'd be going, look what happens when a nation rejects absolute morality and God. Look what happens when the eyes of Yahweh don't matter anymore. It's what I think. Look what happens, and let it be a lesson to you that you cannot live without the lawgiver and the judge and the king. But the writer of Judges is much more artful and subtle than that. All you get is this pearl of an ending sentence. Listen to this. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did, the Hebrew says, what was right in his own eyes. Whoa, now I get it. What I've done is I've replaced the eyes of Yahweh as my moral criterion, and I've made my eyes. Doesn't that sound like postmodernism? Everyone does what's right in their own eyes. What's your truth? What's your morality? Well, good for you. That's right. That's true for you. What a bunch of baloney. How can it all be true? And here's the writer in a subtle, beautiful way saying, well, if your eyes are the criterion, that's where it takes you. That's where it takes you as well. That's the refugee camp that we're about to blow apart with the guns we're selling them. By the way, the brother can't hack it, and he goes and blows up one of the trucks and kills himself in the process. And just, he actually takes this moral stand in a sick kind of a way. But the choice is clear. Do I want the eyes of Yahweh, or do I want my eyes to be the moral criterion? And I think the writer of Judges uses that same, look what happens when you remove morality argument. I think that film does the same thing. Look what would happen if a person just lived completely an amoral life. Would they be happy? What effect would they have on the world? It's a great film to start a conversation about these things. Now, please, I'm not suggesting that the law is the gospel. They're very, very different things. But I do think before you sense a need of the gospel, you have to be convinced of the fact that there is a law and that you've broken it. That's step one. I think that's more than just an intellectual thing. I don't try to replace the Holy Spirit when I'm talking to guys about this stuff. I'm just trying to turn up and do my job as a witness and try to put some logic behind there, give a reason for the faith that is in me so that the Spirit can work on them. I think I've got a fifth column within them who's on my side, arguing the same way I am with this stuff. And that's the win. So I think film can be very useful. You take people to watch a film like that, and that conversation happens pretty naturally afterwards. And you as a Christian may get put on the spot. Well, what do you think? How do you play that? Great opportunity to have an answer ready to give, to make the moral argument. Oftentimes, movies will raise moral points, won't they? And so there's your in. But we need to hasten on. Here's another one. 6-ish years ago, I think it was. Anyone seen this one? Okay. About eight of us. What did you think? Sorry? It was, wasn't it? It was. Yeah, it was. Women's boxing was controversial enough. Then the whole thing about euthanasia at the ending. That's what most Christian websites, film analysis websites went to. Oh, euthanasia, whoa, in Bush's America, whoa. It was a huge deal, and rightly so. I take a different bit of attack in looking at it, and for me it boils down to the interesting issue of the ending. And the sad ending of this film, just to put it very briefly, the Hilary Swank character is this lovable waitress from Ruffsville, horrible family life, horrible poverty in the background, southern, tragic kind of story, who just wants to box. She just loves it more than anything else. And eventually she persuades the Clint Eastwood character. If you just look, the body language will tell you enough, okay? This is early in the film. Look at the way he's looking. Look at the height difference. Look at her posture leaning towards him, his leaning away from her. Look at her. And there, that's their first physical contact. He, all right, eventually he agrees he'll coach her because she's doing such a bad job hitting the power ball. He's like, all right, I'll coach you. And there's a bit of aggression between them. Then that's their first touch of kindness. Then there's that. I mean, look at it. Look at his stance. He's back going, oh, am I really going to accept you? We find out he's got a rotten relationship with his daughter. He's carrying a whole lot of guilt. And he's constantly going to church every day of the year to his local Catholic church and abusing the priest and being just a rat bag because he carries so much guilt about something. We never find out what. And his daughter doesn't speak to him. And he's like, oh, he's got daughter issues. Is he going to let her into his life? And look at him standing back there. Look at the body language. And look at her. Please, please, you know, accept me. I haven't had a dad. Come on. Can there be some love here? And eventually they get that friendly. And again, he's still the boss. He's still guarded off to her. He's got an arm blocking between them. But she's completely open to him and comfortable. But he's getting pretty close to letting his guard down. Bad choice of phrase in that film. And then look at that. Cut from the same cloth. He's touching her like a daughter. He's so proud of her. And it's beautiful. Until in a moment of injustice, she's felled by this dirty fighting enemy. Neck broken. Bang. Oh. And you're going, okay, what's this film going to do now? Is it going to turn into a film of Johnny Erickson Tata, of, you know, surviving terrible physical handicaps and being optimistic anyway? No, it's not. She's in hospital. Nothing's going to change. She wants to die. She tries all these horrible ways to kill herself. And I think Hilary Swank deserves the Best Actor gong for that. Just the way her face changes. It's just facial acting at its best. Changes from this bright, fit young woman to just a... Oh, I don't know how to put it in words. See? Pretty much. She's still alive in the brain, but just doesn't want to be there. Eventually, he goes and helps her die. Oh, huge moral issues. And we could talk about that. We could peck away at the morality there, for sure. And the Catholic priest says, if you do that, you'll feel terrible. In actual fact, he does, and he feels fine. So religion's role in this film is not that positive. But then, the issue really is, what do you do with a tragic ending? in a sense, the shape of the story is the writer's biggest statement. Here's a Hollywood screenwriter, Robert McKee, who says, "Stripped of its surface of characterization and location, story structure reveals the author's personal cosmology, an insight into the deepest patterns and motivations for how and why things happen. Values are at the soul of our art. The writer shapes story around a perception of what's worth living for, what's worth dying for, what's foolish to pursue, the meaning of justice and truth." In decades past, writer and society more or less agreed on these questions, but more and more ours has become an age of moral and ethical cynicism, relativism and subjectivism, a great confusion of values. Ain't that the truth? And we'll skip this for lack of time, but we see in the ending of a film is where, you know, what are our options? You get a happy ending, or you can get an unhappy ending. Duh. Within the unhappy ending category, you've got the classic tragedy. Now, the classic tragedy, first of all, it gives you catharsis. You watch the film, you come away kind of morally cleansed and kind of like going, whoa, okay, yeah, right, I'm morally awakened. Not just a comedy that makes me laugh, it's made me go, whew, sit up and pay attention. Great. I feel cleansed. You also get moral lessons. Macbeth, don't kill Scottish kings. Okay? Book of Judges, don't ditch God and go after gods, or you'll get pagan cycle and your morality will suffer, and the weakest and the most beautiful in your society will suffer. Okay, great. You also get a sense of, occasionally you have an unhappy ending where there's altruism, like he stopped the bullet for his buddy, but he was glad to do so and his buddy lived on. Lovely. That's your beautiful mixed ending. But there's also a thing called a Nietzschean tragedy, named after Friedrich Nietzsche. And the basic point there is to say, it doesn't say like a classic tragedy, learn from this. It just says, you know what? Life is mean. Life is tough, and then you die. It's actually a bleak view of the world. And a Nietzschean tragedy says, yeah, people suffer. Suck it up. Get over it. Face it. That's what happens. I would argue that there's been a rise in the last decade or so of Nietzschean tragedies. Hollywood, and lots of writers have made this point, American cinema used to be all about the lovely, happy Disney ending. Not anymore. And many have said, you know, compare it to French film, which, for example, overgeneralizing, has been quite happy with a negative ending. Why? Because that country had a centuries-long experimentation with atheism. And if there is no scriptwriter in the sky, why do you expect an upending? Whereas America has had a Judeo-Christian view that at the end you might suffer a bit, but keep dreaming because at the end you'll get to your promised land. They may have ripped God out of that story. They wanted Christianity without the Jesus and faith without the God, and they've just, it's been faith in faith or faith in pixie dust or something. But that's been the overall shape of their dream. It's had an upending. France, down ending. Over the last 10 years or so, and many critics have pointed this out, that's changed. Used to be that a negative ending was just box office death in the US. Not anymore. And you could list them off. Mystic River, Cold Mountain, blah, 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 blah. There's dozens of films that just go, you know what, Nietzsche was right, life is a tragedy, and then you die. No redemption? No. Why? Because it fits really well with the secular point of view. And I find that's a pretty interesting argument to make with people. You know, how do you see life going? Do you expect a Nietzschean tragedy for your own life? Or is there something in you that's wired up to expect some kind of faith ending? If so, what's your faith in? I think I found that to be a question that really opens people up to discussion of the existence of God and to personal faith and its benefit. Because I believe every human being, even a depressed one, is wired up to believe that life does actually, their life does matter, that it is going to end well, that they long for eternity. I think God has put eternity in their hearts, as Solomon put it. And I think that actually we've all got that desire in us for our own narrative to be positive and to end well. We all have a sense of wanting to live in a great big narrative. I was going to quote to you from an atheistic filmmaker called Louis Buñuel. I'll just quote you a couple of things. "The thought of death has been familiar to me for a long time, but there's not much to say about it when you're an atheist. When all is said and done, there's nothing. Nothing but decay and the sweetish smell of eternity," whatever that means. "Only one regret. I hate to leave while there's so much going on. It's like quitting in the middle of a serial," says this director of, I don't know, 35 films or something. I wish my story would keep going. I think we're built for narrative. Thank you. Do you?
Well, yeah, we got 1 minute.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't, it's sort of fitting that we should stop it
we'll stop in the middle of the narrative.
Yeah. I think I've always felt behind what you had to say, and we haven't left any time for questions, really. But if we do have a couple of questions, just please ask them quickly.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Yeah, isn't that true? Isn't that true? Yeah. It's a great question. Just for the tape, the question is, so many films seem to present Catholicism as Christianity. Perhaps there's a couple of answers. One is just the size, I guess, of that church globally. And two is the history, very brief answer, if you look at the history of American filmmaking, evangelicals walked away from it and just said, oh, it's Babylon, Satan can have it. Catholics and Jews hung in there and said, look, we'll deal with this profound secularization and we'll try and keep own part of that market. I think they were smart in doing that. And they've certainly managed to stay on screen in a way that some of us as evangelicals perhaps covet. But I take your point. Thank you. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, great question. There's a number of sources out on it. One of the best ones, in my opinion, is damaris.org.uk. Don't go to damaris.co.uk. That's a lingerie site. Okay? Very careful how you write that. I made the mistake this morning, actually. I was just doing a little bit of final research for this. I'm like, damaris.co.org. But that's a very good site. The other one is Hollywood Jesus. That's, to be honest, a little bit more light and Californian. This one's British, and it's actually got... That sounds terrible. You know, I'll leave that out. But that one's got quite a bit of solid content to it. But yeah, Hollywood Jesus is not a bad place to start either.
Okay, well,
HollywoodJesus.com. Hollywood Jesus, yeah.
Yeah.
There's also a great book by Robert Banks. If you... I think it's in Coorong. Mental blank. Sorry, I've blanked on the title, but Robert Banks, an Australian scholar who's published really well on this stuff. Michael Frost as well, from Morling College, has done some great work in this area.
Okay. Well, we can continue this discussion if we want. We're into afternoon tea now, so I think we've got to go back to the main auditorium at 3:10. So you've actually got 25 minutes if you wanted to hang around and talk.
Sure, yeah.
I'm just going to, first of all, give Grenville, this is a...
thank you very much.
Expression of our appreciation.
Thank you.
And
great. Thanks, guys.